Okay, today is the 16th of June, and the sun is not out. It's been a rainy, it must have been a couple of weeks by now, huh?
Yes.
And we're here at the Concord Free Library in pursuit of the issue of the built and natural environment around Concord. Can you say my name is?
My name is Sarah Winstead Wilbur, and I'm known in Concord as Wynn Wilbur.
And we never ask people their age, but maybe you'd give me your date of birth so we can put this in a historical context. I'm interested in.
I was born in 1933.
And the day?
January 27th. 1933, and I've lived in Concord for 40 some years. Moved here in the winter of 65.
Has that been long enough to make you a local?
Oh, never. Your mother has to be born here to be a local. We're from away.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe in that case, you'd tell me a little bit about your people and where you were raised.
Oh, okay. I was raised in New Jersey and spent my summers in Virginia with my father's parents on a farm. And my mother was from New Jersey, although originally her people came from Germany. And so I had a mix of long-term English farmers and rather conservative rural Baptist Southerners and more recent Presbyterian American Germans.
Mm-hmm. And a bit about your education?
I went through public schools and then to a girls
in
New Jersey and then to a small girls private school and then went to Bryn Mawr College and graduated in 1955 with a degree in European history. And then after I was married and had children, I went back to college part-time and have a master's in education from Northeastern University here in Boston.
Wow. Very impressive. Mm-hmm. So what was your path to Concord?
I married a husband, and I was married right out of college, and we traveled to various places. He worked for several construction and building materials companies. And we lived in Georgia and New Mexico and then in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and then in New York, outside New York City in Hastings for about 5 years. And then he, that division of whatever it was, closed. And he took a job with Arthur D. Little, which is a consulting firm, used to be a consulting firm in Cambridge. And he was a management consultant for many years. So to do that, we moved to Concord. And his aunt and uncle lived here and took us around to various towns and showed us houses. And they said, but the only place to live is Concord, really. And so that's what we did.
And where did you end up roosting in Concord?
We live on the ridge, which is up behind the Olcott Orchard House. And we have a house that was built in the 50s. It's a modern fake colonial. And it's a nice little neighborhood of used to be colonials and ranches and a few split levels, capes, that kind of houses.
Used to be?
Well, one of my issues is that Concord is changing very radically, and our neighborhood was considered very desirable for bigger houses to be built. And so as houses came on the market, a number of times developers bought the houses and tore them down and then built very much larger houses on the same lots. And so it's now a mix of what we used to have, and I think we have 5 very big houses, 6,000 square feet, which is good size.
And what does that feel like? Talk about that a little bit.
I'd be glad to talk about that. I had thought you might want to talk first about the demolition delay bylaw and its implications for Concord, and then about this more recent phenomenon of so many not historic, not enormous, famous or wonderful owners, but nice, moderate-sized houses being torn down.
Let's do it that way. Yeah.
Is that all right with you?
Fine. Yeah.
Okay. I'll just back up a little bit and tell you how I got into things. Excuse me, I have a morning hack. I taught for a number of years in a quasi-independent school in Concord, in Lexington, in Lincoln, called the Carroll School, a school for youngsters with reading disabilities who are dyslexic. And it was partly privately paid for by their parents and partly paid for by towns. So I had, for many years, a pretty demanding day schedule. I have four children who were growing up at that point. And then when things eased up a bit, I became more involved in various town committees and joined the Historical Commission in 1996, I think. And at that point, they had already been looking at a way of protecting houses that were not in an historic district. The way Massachusetts works, which I think most listeners might know, is that we have historic districts which are approved by the state and which have very rigid controls. The Historic District Commission can control the color of a house, anything that appears on the street, the windows, the replacement of windows, the paint colors, whether you put a fence of a certain height in front of the house and change your driveway paving and things like that. Concord has four and now five such districts. One of them runs down Lexington Road, which is just below where we live, and is it's called the American Mile. It's the roads where the British soldiers marched into Concord on April 19th, and it's also the road where the American militia harried them on the way back when they retreated back to Boston. So those houses are protected, and they can't be destroyed or changed in any major way. There are, however, in various outlying areas of Concord, a number of other houses that are important, we felt, because of one of four criteria. They have either cultural, political, architectural, or social history. And the social history part can include an important person lived there, an important event happened there. It might have been designed by a man who became a famous architect. Andrew Hepburn is one of those in our area.
Who's that?
Hepburn, a man named Hepburn. And another is Harry Little, who... there was a reason to preserve these houses because of those areas of significance. And I think, I hope in the near future, they will also, the Historic Commission will also look at some of the houses that were designed in the modern era by Gropius and his Bauhaus school. Gropius himself lived in Lincoln in a little house that's sort of looks like a concrete box, and it's quite an amazing use of space. And there are several of those in Concord. So to back up again, the historic districts control houses within, their commission controls the houses that are historic within the five historic districts. they can add another district or another house through going to town meeting and presenting reasons why this is important to add. And if they win the support of the area and of the town in general, the town meeting will pass it usually. But these other houses are, well, in our town at least, they were not protected, and some of them seem to be threatened by developers or new owners who didn't see their value for one reason or another, the reason to preserve them. And so in the early 90s, the Historical Commission, which is a separate organization from the historic districts who only handle historic district houses, the Historical Commission looked at something called a demolition delay bylaw, which does not have the teeth of being in a historic district because then you can't destroy something, but it has some teeth. And they drew up a list of houses, and they also produced, in the early 90s, a huge survey of all the neighborhoods in town and all the houses or even areas of houses. It could be a street or several streets of houses that that exist. They covered everything that was built before 1939 in this big four-volume document, which is now available, I think, online, and it's available on paper in the library. From that, a man named the committee, and I think led by a man named Richard Foreman, who was a macrogeologist, I guess he's called, at Harvard, and who lives in Concord. They assigned a value, a ranking to each of the houses, both in the districts and outside the districts, based on these four criteria, cultural, political, architectural, and social. And they numbered them 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, practically everything numbered 1 was already in a historic district. Practically most of the things numbered 2, but not all, were in historic districts. Very few houses or structures at the third level, and almost none at the fourth level, were in historic districts. This is, I can show you. I mean, obviously the audience can't see that, but this is what the...
What is the title of this document?
It's a short summary, a précis, of the four-volume, and it's called Historic Resources Master Plan of Concord, Massachusetts.
2001.
And this was done 2001. The earlier document was done on 1995, and then parts of it, in fact, I think this was done in 1995 and then updated in 2001. Maybe this is what it looks like. People from the outside say, this is impossible to use, this is a crazy thing, because instead of being the whole town in order, it's West Concord, and then it will have the places in West Concord, and then it'll have houses, and then historic buildings that are not houses, and that would include the prison, and a bridge, and a water tower, and some silos, things like that. And then it will have yet other things. There's a burial ground. There's a wonderful little burial ground over in Fairhaven, which is where they put the people who were victims of smallpox. And it's called the Smallpox Cemetery. It has two stones, no label on it at all. You'd never know it was there. But this is where at least 9 or 10 people who died of smallpox were buried. They somehow felt, well, I don't think they didn't want to bring them into town. And they had a smallpox hospital, a house that was used as a hospital out there. And they felt that it was unsafe to have even their bodies near other people, which is a little weird, but anyhow.
And this would have been roughly what you...
This, I don't know. I think it was in the late 1700s or early 1800s. It was way back. There are also several other spots where there are two or three people buried in the back of somebody's backyard on Main Street, just on past the underpass of the railroad. There's a house that has some. So anyway, that's the kind of thing they wanted to preserve. They didn't want somebody coming in and saying, oh, here's a nice lot, let's build a house on it. And, but this particular document, you can see the numbering, 1, 2, 3, 4 here.
We're on page 146 and 147.
Yeah. And, well, it starts this whole description of the... On page whatever 136. It is, 136, and goes to I think 152.
Now, where are the ratings you were talking about?
The ratings are right here.
Oh, I see.
There's the priorities.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And over here, this is the existing protections, so that some of them are on the National Register. Some of that's a National Landscape, I think. LD is a local district, and goodness, what's FO?
FO.
I don't, federal. I think it's a federal. Protection of some sort. You'll find an SO for the state. Oh, it's federally owned and state owned.
Okay.
Yeah, so that would be the couple of the houses in the national parks fit into that category. This is the date the house was built. This is a, it starts with the address and then the reason why it's important, historic resource, and that's the owner or the blockhouse on Lowell Road is a house that was originally used for protection against the Indians. And it was originally on Main Street, where right next to where the South Burying Ground is today, where Kai's Road is. And when they built the new, the then new bank in 1930 about, that winter, they put this house on rollers and dragged it across the mill dam and took it over to Lowell Road. And it's about, it's just before the parking lot to the right, was it Rite Aid this year, or the drugstore there? And Rick Wheeler, whose family goes back 300 years in Concord, would tell you that the favorite activity of Concordians in the old days was moving houses and suing their neighbors. Those were the two things that they loved to do. And so a lot of these houses have been moved, actually. Several of them have. There was a house here where the library is that was moved a block or two over to Stowe Street. Not Stowe, Hubbard. Yeah. So, but anyway, this house, the block house, we also did a lot of research on, and it has walls that are about 2 feet deep. And these deep, deep window sockets in it—it's just fascinating. Now, I really have to parenthetically say that, as a historian and someone who's very interested in houses and people, I think houses and people are inseparable. That you can't. There's no point. There's no meaning to a house, or for that matter. A barn or a water tower or a prison, except apart from its impact and its role in the lives of people. So that when I was involved with the Historical Commission, those were things we looked at and considered. The way the four-volume book is put together is that it has the architectural description of the house in one section, and then it will have the historical significance of it just below that, and that will talk about early owners and events that happened there and the kinds of a little bit about the private lives of early owners. It never lists the current owner by name as a courtesy, I guess, but once you're out of there, it's all safe to talk about. And so that's been very interesting to research and fascinating to know about, to me. Mm-hmm. Now I've been all around Robin Hood's barn. I'm sorry. I've lost the thread of where we started.
This is great. So anyway,
the idea was that the houses that were first priority were pretty much all saved. Many of the second priority houses were not saved, and because of that, they were vulnerable to demolition. And so we, before I got on the board, other people had looked at this list and said, well, let's save everything that's a level two or a level three, and that came out to something like 900 houses. And that we thought would never get through town meeting. And so they went back to the drawing board and said, no, they were going to present it to town meeting in 95 and then withdrew the warrant article and said, no, let's wait a while and think this through again. And so what we did was to look at the list and be very much more limited and just take houses that were level twos and a few level threes. And also, we did include, though, the water tower out at Madison's Farm, the little bridge that goes across Westford Road to, what is it called, Spencer Brook Road, and a couple of silos, barns with silos, there's a little house that's a log cabin and on Monument Street behind the big house. That kind of thing, as well, and the smallpox cemetery, as well as these level two, level three houses. And again, most of them were built fairly long ago, but a few, the West Concord Depot, things like that, I think they're probably early 20th century, late. And we went through a year-long process where we met with the owners. We invited all the owners to come to a meeting and hear our proposal and offer their suggestions and objections. And as you would expect, all the ones who objected came, and some of the ones who have supported came. And then we put together the article and worked it out with the specifics of it. Worked it out with the building commissioner because it would be his job to protect or to decide whether a house merited being put on the demo delay list. The way Concord did it was somewhat different from the state pattern, and in retrospect, I'm not sure we did the right thing. What the state historical commission recommends is that you pick a date and say all houses that were built before 1900 or all houses that are 50 years old or 75 years old should be subject to a demo delay. Just at least a look through. Many of them could probably go down. Some should have the whole hearing process. In Concord, we were afraid that would never go through because we had so many houses that were older. And so we didn't do it that way. We did this, and because we had the historical survey already, we used that and the priority list. And a few slipped through the sieve, which is too bad. There were several houses that, at least one that was not on, was not protected by the historic district, and it was not on our list, that was torn down a couple of years ago. And as soon as it was sold and people realized it was going to be torn down, there was great despair, but there was nothing to be done. I won't go through the whole criteria for how a demo delay works because anyone who's interested can look at it in this book.
This is page 213.
Yeah, and it's the summary of the article as it was presented at town meeting and voted on. But one of the interesting details of it is that the question was what constitutes demolition, because just before this went through, there was somebody who said, oh, I'm not going to demolish the house, and they left one wall and then built another house around the outside of it, so the one wall is invisible and the other house says it looks nothing like the one that was torn down. But, you know, so the definition of demolition that we worked out with our building commissioner was that it be a substantial proportion, and that substantial be defined as the substantial destruction would be defined as either half of the volume of the building or half of its value as determined by the building commissioner. The volume is pretty obvious. You just measure the square feet and then the heights of the building. The value would be his determination. And then we picked out this listed group, and we chose a six-month delay period because we thought that would go through town meeting, really. I think in retrospect we should have made it 12 months, and I know there's been a consideration of expanding it to 12 months. 6 months, a builder can wait you out. 12 months is a long time to tie up your capital and might discourage people from buying a house in order to demolish it. There's a very long, complicated procedure where a person who wants to demolish a house goes to the building commissioner for a permit. If it's on the list, the historical commission is notified. They have a hearing within 14 days and say, yes, it's okay to demolish it, or no, wait. And if they say no, wait, it goes into the six-month delay period. And then various things happen. The idea of it is not to always prevent demolition, because that doesn't happen, but to encourage the owner to find a way to either rehab it or move it, perhaps sell it to someone else and move it to another site, or, barring all of that, allow the historical commission to come in and take photographs of the house and its significant architectural details. That last process has happened just recently with a house that's on the list. It's the Samuel Hoare House, which is right, it's hidden, but it's at the edge of Great Meadows. And Samuel Hoare was a state senator who was very interested in environmental issues and in birds, and he already owned the area that's now Great Meadows and put in the dikes to make ponds so that there'd be nesting areas for water birds, waterfowl.
H-O-A-R?
H-O-A-R, yes. And he's part of a family of whores who live, that's their name, who lived in town. I don't know that any of them still do. But he built himself a house out there, and so he could see this. And then later on, he gave the 230 acres of Great Meadows to the National Parks, I think. It's owned by the federal government. Now, that might be not a fact. It may be owned by the state, but anyway, it's owned by somebody.
It's protected.
It's protected, yeah. I'm sure it's federally owned, because they allow, it's very weird. You're not allowed to bring a dog into it or picnic, but you can go hunting there. I mean, what kind of, only the feds would come up with an idea like that, wouldn't they? So, but that house has not been torn down. They applied for a demolition permit last summer, and in the fall, the Historical Commission sent an organization who have all kinds of fancy criteria in to do the measured drawings and things like that.
To documentation.
And it's going to be on the, it'll be in the library when it's all put together, and on probably in Leslie Wilson's collections, but people could come and see it.
So which category or categories does that structure fall under? Is it significant architecturally, or is it because he owned it?
I think it's because he had it built and he owned it, and because he was a donor of this very valuable natural resource to the town. So the two, the built and the natural, support each other in that sense. Yes.
Is it architecturally significant?
I've never seen it.
You've never
seen it. The house is hidden behind. If you're familiar with Concord, when you go to the North Bridge on Monument Street, there's a parking lot where you can leave your car and then walk down a long grove of trees to the bridge. And right beside that parking lot, there's another driveway that goes up to three or four houses. And this house is owned by a man who also owns another early 1900s house, big red brick house, and has now high walls, high security fencing around it. And he has a live-in guard there and won't let people go past unless unless they're residents or are visiting one of the residents. There are a few houses just past it, but he's very protective. So I would love to see it. Somebody has seen it and describes it briefly in here. It's not commonly seen, though. Great Meadows, where is it? This part of the book is done alphabetically by the streets, so this is easy to see. Yeah, the description part. Here. This is the Samuel Hoare House here, and he had these dikes constructed to attract waterfowl. So the house is, and the house was built by our local architect Andrew Hepburn.
Colonial Revival.
Right, country estate. And the present owner of the adjacent house, which is the Frederick Chase residence, he owns both, and he wants to tear it down for whatever his personal reasons are, I don't know. I don't think it's inhabited now. I think no one has lived in it recently. So, this demolition delay bylaw went through the procedures, went through town meeting, and was voted with very little opposition. And we drew a deep breath and thought, well, that's done. And about 6 minutes later, a house over on Balls Hill Road, which was on the list, and its barn, which was a number one, the only number high highest priority, came up for demolition. And so there we were. And that became a very, here's the old, it was called the Old Ball House. And Balls Hill Road is a little road off Monument Street with about eight houses on it. And it has this one very old, very, very, badly run down house at the end of the road, and a big old barn adjacent to it, which was probably late 1700s, and the house was probably built around 1725 or between 1725 and 1740. There may have been an earlier house on the site, it's hard to tell, but in doing the historical research for the house, we found deeds and people owning cattle and oxen as part of the, they listed their estate as in the tax rolls as early as 1727 there. Yeah, really, really old. The house itself was a wonderful little, it's not first period, but it's the next thing after that. It's a house with a high front facade facing south, so you get sun into both floors all winter long, and then a long, deep, the back roof that slides way back. I can't remember the name of it at the moment. Anyway, two rooms in the front, a long room in the back, and a little room off to the west side, partitioned off. This house The present owner of the property was a woman who had built a very large, very handsome house up on the hill behind it, not visible from the ball house. But I guess she could look down on it. And she didn't want anything in her view. And at that point, we ran into very difficult, I don't know how to describe this appropriately because I feel pretty strongly about it, but there were many parties with an interest in this area. The town wanted to put in wells, and they wanted to buy part of the land for a future well site. The land slopes down eventually to Concord River.
Water wells?
Yeah, it would be a deep well. And they, so the town and the whoever the water commissioner people are, wanted it for that. The land trust and the people who wanted conservation land wanted to preserve some of the land for conservation. And the town manager was sort of negotiating all these things, and the historical commission was the orphan, not really even at the table until deals had been made. And so even though the house and barn were under this demolition delay bylaw, they had pretty much made the deal with the owner of the land. And she wanted it demolished, and she didn't. It was not in a condition to be moved intact anywhere, and so there weren't very many options, and it was very, very frustrating. However, along came an angel, because living down the road on Monument Street a ways was a family named Bemis. John Bemis is an old Concord family, and his wife, Charlotte Hutchins Bemis, had lived, and her family had lived on Monument Street, sort of on the, I don't know, across the road anyway, not on the water side, for several generations. So they had four children, and one of their children, who all, three of them all still live right in town and are farmers and very big on, one of them runs the gaining ground and that kind of very, very public-spirited people. The fourth child is a daughter who had moved to Idaho but came back periodically, and her name is Jerry Bemis, and she persuaded the family that they should set up a, I guess it's called a foundation, and to preserve the house by dismantling it and saving the pieces of it, and then eventually reassembling it someplace else. And they also dismantled the barn. So the house went on the demolition permit level back in the fall of 2001, I think, and then, or maybe 2000. And then we had about 6 months. We knew that it could not, there was no other buyer. Nobody else was interested in it. We knew it would not be saved. So we arranged with Jerry to have access to the house to empty it. The present owner wasn't, well, that's a whole separate story. I'll tell you that in a minute. The present owner was a man named Coburn Benson. And so we took the house, and he had left and gone with his $1.5 million or $3 million or whatever it was he got for the land and the house and the barn, and went up to Limerick, Maine, and bought another very handsome house and moved the stuff that he wanted from his house out. And he had he had material in other parts around the house, which he also took. And several of us went in and spent several months going in a couple of days a week going through stuff, dumping out things in a dumpster that were no good, and finding levels and levels and levels of stuff, so that
Inside the house.
Now I have to tell you about the Benson family. This house, the Ball Benson house, went into the Ball family sometime in 1720 to 1740, and their descendants lived there probably until 1825. Then another prominent family in town bought it, but apparently didn't really live in it. One of the daughters married somebody, I think, is how it worked out. And then it was briefly owned by a couple of other people. And then in 1887, a family named Benson moved in. And by this time, Monument Street had originally been yeoman farmers, and as time went on, they got richer, and some of them got very wise about how to farm well and did very well by themselves. And so they became gentleman farmers with big estates and great big houses, the houses that you see along Monument Street. And they hired out, young men to farm for them and young women to be their maids and seamstresses and children's governesses and so forth. In some parts of Concord, those people who came and did that work were Irish. And there are lots of Irish farmers along Lexington Road. Those houses were owned by the McHughes and some other people later on. But on Monument Street, at least by the 1880s, they were hiring people from Norway. And they had come, many of them, from one or two little towns in Norway. A couple of brothers would come, and then they'd say, hey, this is pretty good, bring Susie over. And the sister would come, and she'd bring her best friend. And so there was this whole community of Norwegians, young people, young men, young women, who lived, many of them lived, I think, in some kind of, the girls probably lived in maids' rooms on the third floor, and the boys lived in some kind of outbuilding, wherever. And they all intermarried, and that's where the Petersons and the Johnsons and the Andersons and the Bensons all come from. And when you go to Sleepy Hollow and walk along one part of a high ridge, you can see all these names of all these people buried who came in as kids and stayed here. And they intermarried, and sometimes they didn't intermarry but had children. And in fact, one of the interesting things, I'm on the Records and Archives Committee, and we have been going through the old birth records and death records of people from the 1890s and thereabouts. And there are, every year, in early 20th century, every year there are a number of single girls who have a baby, and of many last names. I guess single motherhood is not anything new in Concord. But the Bensons, this man and his wife, were a married couple, and they worked for one of the families. They worked for the Hunts, I think, mostly. But they bought this little house, which was by then 120 years old and probably not in great shape, and they lived there, and they had 9 children, and 7 of them were girls. And if you're a farmer, that's not a good distribution. So the girls grew up and went and worked as maids in the houses along Monument Street, and a few of them married. In fact, one sadly married in 1919, and her husband died a year or two later, I think, of the big flu epidemic. And she had a son, and his son and this Coburn are the only two descendants of that whole group. Many of the girls never married. The older son never married. He lived there his whole life and died when he was 89 or so. And the youngest girl, I think this child is not a legitimate child. She had a son named Coburn, and he grew up there. And the mother died of cancer when she was about 40. So he was 9 years old when his mother died and lived there and was raised by all these aunts and uncle and lived there until he was 60-something. I think he went away and did things and then came back. And he's a fascinating person. He, in his middle years, was always a gifted mechanic, apparently. Worked on cars, worked on something kind of Vincent, I don't know, and had a bunch of old cars and old motorcycles and old motorcycle parts in his barn, and was known to be the best mechanic in that part of town, at least, and people would bring their cars to him. So then in his later years, he took care of the uncle who remained the last. After 1979, I get back, the sisters had all died. And so these two men lived together, an uncle and a nephew who was 25 years younger. And two men living in a house like that who are not housekeepers made for a rather heavy level of debris and detritus and stuff not thrown away and whatever. But the women who had worked in these houses must have been given little things, because as we emptied out the packed back rooms up in the upstairs, we would find a little set of lovely small blue glass wine glasses and a fine piece of linen a dresser scarf and old sheets. In fact, in some of the sheets, a few of them had camp names for, I think it was the Chases who also lived over there, for as though the boy had gone off to camp with these cot sheets, and then when he outgrew that, the mother just gave them to one of the Benson girls and said, here, maybe somebody in your family can use this, because they knew that they had this family of six or seven adults living in this house. And so we kept finding all these fascinating things, and it was really very interesting. It was quite amazing. And also
were those artifacts all preserved?
Not all of them. Some of them were preserved. Some of them were sold. We had a sale to raise money for an archaeological survey, and there was some group in town who does a sale every spring. I think it was at the First Parish, and you could buy a table. And so we did sell some. And so we sold a few things that I now wish we hadn't. One was a United States flag, a great big 4x6 flag, maybe not quite that big, and it had 46 stars on it, which must mean it was from just before New Mexico and Arizona. Were they the two that made 48 states? It must have been from around that window of about 10 years. So anyhow, but gone is gone. And he also had years and years of motorcycle magazines and old records, and I don't know, the family hits, and many old pictures of relatives in the family. And those did go to the library special collections. And all the paper documentation we saved. Later on, that was what the Historical Commission did, just sort of clearing out the stuff that was in the house. There were old pots and pans, there were whatever.
So was Leslie Wilson in the special collections involved in preserving some of these things?
She has them, yes. We brought them to her. Yeah. And she was we brought her a bunch of old books and documents that she said, I'm going to leave these outside. That was the old special collections before the fancy new parts had been set. I'm going to leave these out in the hallway. They look to me as though they might be full of bugs, and I think they were. But so there was this kind. There were old photographs that Coburn had taken. There were photographs from all kinds of earlier places. There were graduation pictures and wedding pictures and so forth of some of these people in the family. When that period ended, and meanwhile, Jerry Benson had hired a man named Dave Ottinger, who was an excellent person at dismantling old houses, and he came in, and during the summer, I think it was all supposed to be done by the end of August, so during the summer, he systematically dismantled the house, numbering every board, every beam, every stud, every whatever, and as they peeled back things, they would find 8 layers of wallpaper in some of the rooms, and Jerry saved samples of most of those. I think she still has them at her family's house. We found down in the basement all kinds of canning jars, you know, mason jars, from many different areas, some with very early lids on them, the glass lids, and some with food in them still. And one of the things we found was a jar of preserves that was dated 1937. I mean, it was just fascinating. It was like peering back into the past and seeing somebody's life from way long ago. But they as they peeled it back, they got past the Benson era, which is probably, and they realized that the house had been remodeled in various ways. There was once a big wing out in the front, which included a garage and a shed and stuff. And that blew down in a hurricane in 1938 and was never rebuilt. At some point, they changed the house from the early traditional gate-leg staircase that comes up the front to a long straight staircase in the back. And they, at that point, redid the chimneys. There is pretty strong evidence that a second family probably lived in the back of the house, maybe one of the children and his, back in the Ball era, one of the children and his family. There was a little room separated off on the west side where, in the, if you imagine a house with the long slanted back, and that part of that was cut off on the west side, and the people who did the dismantling called that Naomi's room, because in the early days there was, in the first Bull generation, or their children, there was a young woman named Naomi who came back to live with them at a certain point. She appears gone in one census and back in another, and she had a baby, but no husband that anybody can find. So they think maybe that was her room for a while. And then I think she lived there as an old woman, too. I didn't go back and review all that, but it was just, you know, it was amazing. There were old soapstone sinks in the kitchen, and they found a second hearth, which is why they think another family lived there. Tremendous old cookstove sort of hearth with an 8-foot brick hearth before the chimney area. And working, when they got back off all the wallpaper and everything, what they were finding was featherboarding, which is the earliest kind of way of building a house, with horizontal boards that are sort of slanted in at the top, and then the next board fits over it. It makes the house weathertight from storms, even though you've only got one layer of wood. And that was painted in the front of a house is called the east room is the hall where people actually lived in the old days, and the west room is the parlor, which was for entertaining the minister and fancy times. And upstairs would be a single bedroom or maybe another. But everybody came down to the hall, and that's where you cooked, and that's where that was a light, sunny east and south exposure, and it was warm. That was the room you kept heated. On that floor, on that wall, they found old, probably blood paint, the red paint that would be the original paint. And in the room, there was
blood paint?
It's made from cow's blood, I think, or something. It's that natural barn red paint. And I don't know the chemical aspect of it, but I think it's made out of the blood of animals that are killed for other purposes. It makes this nice sort of dark, muddy red.
I've never heard of paint.
Maybe I'll go home and find out it's something really different. But There was a secret, but blocked off staircase in the back, in this back room. And that staircase went up to this back little part too, and to another room off, I guess above. There was a room, I don't know, there were extra rooms back there. And on the staircase wall, they found writing in charcoal. And one of the things said April 19, 1775. And up above the beams in the parlor room, we found some paper, and it appears to be a list of people who were Minutemen, and perhaps it was a list of people to notify at times of meetings. And the fact that it was hidden up there looks as though they were trying to keep it from somebody's eyes. And when they got down to the basic boards and lifted those in the parlor, they found that the boards had probably been turned over, had originally had the other side up, and the underside had all these burn marks on it, not near the hearth, but out in the middle of the room, which seemed to indicate that somebody may have been working as a blacksmith in there, possibly making bullets for the Minutemen. I mean, a lot of this is conjecture, and there's no way to prove it anymore, but there was an old door when they turned the boards over, when they got down to the bottom boards, they found the scrape mark where a door scrapes as you open it, a big arc. There was a door to the west, which is no longer there. It's been turned into a window. The windows had been changed from the early ones to larger ones. They found the old window frames. I mean, it's just when you dismantle a house slowly and look at everything, you find the most fascinating, wonderful, surprising things. You just think, ooh, now what were they doing that for? Why was this? It's just wonderful. The other thing that was really surprising was that we found some shoes, early handmade shoes, one above a doorway at the back of the parlor, which made people think that maybe this lean-to was added later, and that was the original exit. And also some corn husks and other stuff. But there was a child's shoe there. There was a woman's shoe under the door sill in the main entrance. And some research turned up the fact that early settlers and people in this country were modern and Christian in one way, but also were hedging their bets against witches in other ways. And they thought that a shoe, particularly, I think maybe a shoe of a child who has died, would be a protection to keep evil spirits from coming in through the doorways. Isn't that fascinating? Yeah. So those things are at UMass now, much to my aggravation. They came in and did the archaeological parts of the survey, and they took the archaeological evidence and included some Indian points and different kinds of bits of pottery and shards, and there's a big archaeological report that's been written about the house and the environs around it. So, and all that, I guess, they have in a drawer someplace, and I really think it should come back to Concord. Oh, but, yeah, I mean, I don't quite. I have written to Brona Simon a couple of times, and she blithely doesn't say anything. She's the state archivist. So I think probably somebody official in town has to request it, and the library, or somebody has to say, we want those back. We paid for the survey, so it seems to me that would be legitimate. So where was I?
So was the house then dismantled?
What they were doing was peeling back layer after layer after layer, numbering every board, putting them in the big trailer, and eventually they got back to, by late summer, just the skeleton of the house. And there's this beautiful skeleton. I wish I could show you the pictures that Leslie has downstairs, because we kept a photographic history of the steps as it happened. Yeah, the dismantling. And it does exist. And Jerry Bemis herself took thousands of pictures, and what she's done with them, I don't know. But, and in fact, another man who was a Concord resident, Lance Old, came over and videoed parts of the dismantling. So he has pictures of stages where they're lifting off the roof or when they're doing this. But when you see just the skeleton of it, it's these beautiful, clean lines, this beautiful little house. So someday, maybe.
Where will it be?
Well, that's the great mystery wrapped up in the enigma. It's been 6 or 7 years, and we just all hope that the wood mites or whatever they are aren't working away at it. It's in these two trailers, which are presently out at the edge of the filter beds in town, and I know the town is eager to get them moved someplace.
It's waiting for a site.
Yeah, and the barn also is waiting for a site, and various options have been suggested, and I don't know whether any of them are financially reasonable. The barn was in pretty bad shape. They were able to save the beams. It had vertical siding on most of it rather than horizontal, which is kind of odd. And a great three-bay front with huge sliders that you pulled apart. And inside it, oh my God, all kinds of stuff. But again, it had the modern things that Coburn had been using, the oil and grease and motorcycle and car pieces and parts and whatever. And it had, in the back, cow stanchions, because they had had cattle at one point. And a cow stanchion is a narrow strip where you lead the cow in. She puts her head through this narrow vertical bars, and then there's a little thing that twists so that she's held in place when you're doing the milking, and then the cows can be released. But there are several other barns in Concord that have that same kind of thing. But they were wonderful, and there was all kinds of everything under the sun. Coburn himself was God's first pack rat. Oh, my Lord, he had everything in the world. I don't think he ever threw out anything his mother, his aunts, his grandfather had ever had. And so he had 2 old school buses back in the woods, and they were chock-a-block with fabric and sheets and clothes and dresses and photographs of everybody. And he took most of that up to the place in Maine. But some of it did end up in the special collections. Not the clothing or anything, but some of the pictures. And so there was just these two families who lived there generation after generation in both cases. And it's quite unusual to have a house that's almost 250 years plus old with majorly 2 families, just the Bensons, just the Balls and then the Bensons.
But it tells this whole story beyond just those two families.
Yeah,
too.
Right.
This whole Swedish influx.
This whole Norwegian,
of
yes,
labor,
right.
Young laborers.
Yeah.
Wow,
right, it was fascinating, right, it was. And I think originally, what happened eventually was they had electricity, but they didn't have running water in the house. They had put pipes out to a well in the front yard, but the pipe wasn't deep enough or something, and it froze. And after repairing it 2 or 3 times, I think in the last decade, Coburn said, oh, the heck with it. And so he just drew water from the well and didn't bother to have running water inside the house. So they didn't have, and there's no bathroom in the house. There never was a bathroom in it, which leads one to wonder. And there's no, at the time we were there, there was no signs of an outhouse outside either. But when the sisters were there, it must have been more civilized. It had electricity and water, and I'm sure they had an outhouse. And Coburn, because they had this wonderful antique pump, and there was a picture in the paper of Coburn with the pump. And then he left, and sometime in the week soon after that, somebody stole the pump, which was too bad because it was a nice water pump. So there it is. It was a fascinating place. It was a fascinating winter to work there. And another man, Joe Wheeler, and I, and a few other people from the commission, we'd go over in the mornings in January and February and March, and it was warm enough with the sun coming in. This is what I really learned about how important orientation of a house is. With the front door open and working with all this dusty stuff and the old layers of old rugs and trying to get rid of all this stuff, we had the doors and sometimes the windows open, and it was not cold. I mean, it was comfortable to work there, and it was full of light. It was just a wonderful, I loved that house. It was really very special. It had the east part, the hall, had quite old stuff. The west part, this parlor, had been modernized and had paneling and had plaster and stuff that was more recent, and a more recent shallow fireplace, probably done in the late 1700s, early 1800s. So,
wow.
So anyhow.
That's wonderful.
So that was...
That's probably longer than you intended to talk about
that. I'm sorry, you probably...
No, but it's so revealing of what's important about
to save these
preservation
things, right.
and
Well, this was just really very, very special. We were also... how much time do we have?
About 10 minutes left.
Of the whole time?
Yeah.
Oh, do you want me to talk about neighborhood conservation? I better then, if your whole time is up. Yeah, we better leave
that or Louisa May Alcott?
Yeah, that's all the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah. The other thing that I have been involved in the past 10 years is an attempt to start a neighborhood conservation district, to get a neighborhood conservation district bylaw for Concord. And this is a concept that came up about 2005 at the state level, was approved by the Attorney General at that point. And since our own street had seen so many houses being torn down that were not tiny run-down houses but were good-sized colonials with an average square footage on the floors of that's not the right paper. That won't tell me anything. About 2,850 square feet. Those are the ones that pre-existed 2,000. The new ones that have been added on our street average 6,000 to 370 square feet.
Three times the size.
Three times the size. Very big. 9-foot ceilings. Media rooms. 9-foot ceilings in the basement. Huge facades all the way across the front of the house. And, that's where a facade is, isn't it, come to think of it? All right. Where's your brain, Winnie?
You're doing fine, Winnie.
So these little houses were all being replaced by very much bigger houses, and it just seemed to us that this was not a healthy thing for the town. And I go back to...
In what sense?
In several senses. Concord traditionally was a town of people of mixed income. There were a few very rich people. There were a lot of moderate income people, middle class people, and there were certainly some people who were struggling to keep their heads above water. And there was housing. There were young people. There were elderly people. And there was housing available for all those different groups. And what I see happening in the past decade is that the poor, or not the very poorest, may be able to get low-income housing, get into some of those units. But the young families who are moderate income people or older people who are moderate income people are being squeezed out. And it's partly market forces. Concord is just within comfortable driving distance of Boston, and it has public transportation. The neighborhoods here, some of them have nice little cul-de-sacs and quiet streets and areas that would be residentially very desirable for families with children or for families who just want a certain amount of peace and quiet. And there are a lot of, certainly earlier this decade, there were a lot of people who were interested in buying a house for an investment and then moving on after a few years, maybe. So that we personally ended up living on a circle, which was off the main road and one block from a main drag into Boston. And developers looked at us and said, "You, this is what we want." And one after another, they came in and bought ranches and colonials and capes and demolished those houses, bought them for $700,000 or $800,000, demolished them, which means that now the land is worth $700,000 or $800,000 to the developer, and built enormous houses in order to make a profit on what they had done. And those houses were selling for $1.5 million or more. I see this as changing the whole culture of Concord and squeezing out the lower middle class people, and financially I'm talking about, and introducing a new group who are not bad people. They're lovely women who live on our street, and we're friends, and they have nice kids. But these are people who are young and very wealthy, and it's changing what Concord historically has been. And I think it's a loss to Concord. It's difficult to change this because some of the elderly people who sell their houses want necessarily to make as much profit as they can, and in order to have money to live on for the rest of their lives or to move into a retirement community or go to Florida, whatever they do. And this mansionization, though, I think is an unfortunate step for town. So anyway, we with a number of the people in our neighborhood tried to create a neighborhood conservation district, it's called, for a bylaw which would, the bylaw would cover the whole town, but what it said was, if a neighborhood wants to create its own neighborhood conservation district and puts together its criteria and gets approval from the town, it may do so. Nobody has to do it. No neighborhood is required to do it. This is any neighborhood's own choice. So it was going to be two articles, one creating the basically permission to create such a district in your own neighborhood, and the second was a district for our neighborhood. We had the support of 15 of the 20 families on our street, and most of those people worked pretty hard to make the thing work. We invited everybody in the street and in the larger neighborhood to be participants. We did the historical research showing that we abut the Alcott House and the Samuel Prescott House in the back, and changes to houses on top of the hill are visible from those very valuable historic houses. And we wanted to establish certain criteria that would limit various things in new buildings. I think we made a mistake in trying to do both things the same year, and would have been better if we had done our own neighborhood a second year, but we were really concerned because houses were going down so fast. And so our specifics were to have It would have, the criteria that would have been involved were enlarging the setback between on the sides lots, insisting that there be a determination about how much shadow the house, the new house being built, would cast on the houses in the neighborhood already.
Literally shadow. Literally
shadow. Yes, uh-huh. You can do a shadow impact by looking at it on a certain day in spring or fall, where you have and it's the theory is that if the house is far enough back, or if it's banked so it isn't a flat wall right up to the third floor, but it's the side of it is set back. You know, you have a wing, and then you have a center part that's further back. You won't cast a shadow you see what the shadow impact is at 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock and noon. At noon, it shouldn't be anything, but at 9 and 3, if you're blocking all the light in the house next door, it matters to the people who've always had a ranch house next to them. And another part of that was the present ruling in town for roof height is that it's 35 feet, but that is determined as halfway between the ridge, which is the very tippy top, and the eave, which is where the roof stops at its lowest level. And halfway between that is 35 feet. So if you have a very steep or extensive roof, it can be another 10 feet higher, and that's legal. We had hoped to make the ridge line 32 feet so that would reduce the height again. And there were a number of other specific criteria about not raising the house, not building up around the house so that the whole house sits higher than other houses on the street, and not making it more than, I think it was 50% or some percentage, larger than houses already on the street. So anyhow, those were the criteria that our neighborhood worked out. We talked about it with people on the planning board. We had a supporter on the selectmen, although not all of them were in favor of it. And we presented it to the town meeting. And the real estate community came out, I think in toto, I would say every realtor in town was there, and they all were against it. And from their perspective, I can see why. They get a commission twice. They sell the first house, it's demolished, they sell the second house. And they kept saying, well, that was just a bad, terrible little house. That wasn't any good, blah, 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 you know, that house. And so far, it was full of mold, or it was full of this or full of that. But anyhow, I think that unless the town makes some kind of determination that limits this building of very large houses in place of small houses, we are going to be a very different community in the future. And I'm afraid it may be to the detriment of Concord's community spirit and the way people are involved in the town and care about it long term. I see you looking at your clock. You're running out.
Just running out of time.
Yeah. All right. Well.
But this has been absolutely fascinating, and I'm.
I'll show you some of the pictures.